This is a reading of the collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Child's Changing Consciousness and Waldorf Education. Actually, it's a cycle. This is the last part. It's called Answers to Questions Given on Various Days. I'm reading them all together. These questions and answers were discussed in Dornach on April 18th, 1923. A question regarding religious instruction is put. Rudolf Steiner answers. A misunderstanding has arisen through my preliminary remarks about the child's development in regard to its religious impulses. So far nothing has been said in my lectures about religious instruction itself, because it was only today that I began to talk about the practical application of Waldorf pedagogy. What I had told you was that there exists a kind of physical religious, I call it a bodily religious relationship, between the child and its environment. Furthermore, I said that what the young child exercised, simply on account of its organism, entered the sphere of thinking only after puberty, approximately after the 14th to 15th year. What manifests itself at first physically, spiritually, and then continues its existence in a hidden way until it re-emerges in the thinking realm only in approximately the 15th year, I compared with an underground stream surfacing again on lower ground. In the case of the adult, religion is closely linked to the thinking sphere. However, if pedagogy is to be in line with the child's natural development, careful preparation for what will emerge later on already has to be made during an earlier stage. And so the question arises, bearing in mind these laws of human development, how are the religious lessons to be planned for pupils between the ages of 6 and 14? This is one of the questions that will be dealt with in the coming lectures. However, in anticipation, I would like to say that we must be clear about the fact that the religious element is simply inborn in the child, that it is part of the child's being. This is revealed particularly clearly through the child's religious orientation up to the change of teeth, as I have already described it. What has eventually become religion in our general civilization, taken in an adult sense, is something that naturally belongs to the world of ideas, or at least depends on ideation for its content, which, true enough, lives itself out mainly in the adult's feeling realm. Only after the 14th year does the adolescent gain the necessary maturity for appreciating the ideational quality and content of religion. For the class teacher, grades 1 through 8, the important question therefore arises, how must we arrange our religion lessons? Or more precisely, to which part of the child must we appeal through our religion lessons during this age from the 7th to the 14th year? During the first life period, up to the change of teeth, we directly affect the child's physical organization through our educational influence. After puberty, fundamentally speaking, we work upon the powers of judgment and upon the adolescent's mental imagery. During the intervening years, we work upon the child's feeling life. This is the reason why we must lead the child into this period through a pictorial approach, for pictures work directly upon the feeling, Gemüt. The powers of mental imagery mature only gradually, and they have to be prepared well before their proper time. What we now have to do in our religion lessons is to appeal, above all, to the children's life of feeling, as I will describe it tomorrow in regard to other subjects. The question is, how do we do it? We work upon the children's feelings by letting them experience feelings of sympathy and antipathy. This means that if we develop the kind of sympathies and antipathies between the 7th and 14th year that will finally lead to proper judgments in the religious sphere, we will be acting rightly. And so we avoid an attitude of thou shalt or thou shalt not in our religion lessons, for it would be of little pedagogical value for a child of this age. Instead, we arrange our lessons in a way that will induce feelings of sympathy for what the child is meant to do. We do not explain our real aims to the children. Using the pictorial element as medium, we present to the children what will fill them with feelings of sympathy in a heightened sense, also in a religious sense. And likewise, we try to induce feelings of antipathy toward what they are not meant to do. In this way, on the strength of feelings of right or wrong, and always through the pictorial element, we try to lead the young pupils gradually from what is divine spiritual in nature, via the divine spiritual in the human being, to their making the divine spiritual their own. However, all this has to reach the child through its life of feelings, certainly so up to the eighth grade. What we must avoid is a dogmatic approach or setting up moral commandments. We must do all we can to prepare the child's soul for what later on is to develop into the adult faculty of forming sound judgments. In this way, we shall do far more for the children's future religious orientation than by giving it religious commandments or set articles of faith at an age when it is not yet ready for them. By clothing our content in images, thus preparing the ground for what in later life will emerge as religious judgment, we prepare for our pupils the possibility of grasping through their own spirituality what they are meant to grasp as their own innermost being, namely their religious orientation. By appealing to the children's feeling life in our religion lessons, that is, by presenting our content in pictures rather than through articles of faith or in the form of moral commandments, we grant them the freedom of finding their own religious orientation in later life. It is of immense importance for young people, from puberty right into their 20s, to have the possibility of lifting up, out of their own strength, into conscious individual judgments, what they first received. Given with a certain width and many-sidedness, through their life of feeling, it will enable them to find their own way to the divine world. It makes all the difference whether the children during the age of authority are brought up in a particular religious belief, or whether by witnessing the teacher's underlying religious attitude, they are enabled to pull themselves up like a plant on its tendrils in order to develop their own morality later in life. Having first found pleasure or displeasure in what finally condensed itself into a thou shalt or thou shalt not attitude, and having learned to recognize through a pictorial contemplation of nature how the human soul becomes free through an inner picture of a divine spiritual weaving in nature and in history, a new stage is reached, where the young people's own images and ideas can be formed. In this way, the possibility is given of receiving religious education out of the center of life itself. It is something that becomes possible only after puberty has been reached. The point is that future stages have to be prepared for in the right way, that is, on the basis of the correct insight into human nature. In my lectures, I have used the comparison of the river that disappears underground to resurface lower down. During the first 7 years, the children have an inborn religious attitude. This now enters the depths of their souls, becoming part of them, to resurface in the form of thinking only with the arrival of puberty. During the second life period, we must work into the depths of the pupils' souls through what is revealed to our individual insights. In this way, we prepare them for growing into religious adults. We impede this process if we do not offer our pupils a possibility of finding their own religious orientation later on. In every human being, there exists an individual orientation toward religion, which after the 15th year has to be gradually won. It is our task to prepare the ground so that this may happen in the right way. That is the reason why at this age, we have to treat the religion lessons in the same way as lessons in the other subjects. All of them have to work upon the child's soul through the power of imagery. They have to stimulate the child's feelings. It is possible to introduce a religious element into every subject, even into math lessons. Anyone who has some knowledge of Waldorf teaching will know that this statement is correct. A Christian element pervades every single subject, mathematics included. This fundamental religious current flows through the entire education. But because of prevailing circumstances, we have felt it necessary to come to the following arrangement with regard to religious instruction. And here I should like to point out once more that the Waldorf school is not an ideological, but a pedagogical school, where the fundamental demand is that our teaching methods should be in harmony with the child's nature. Hence we have neither the wish nor the intention of teaching our pupils to become anthroposophists. We have chosen anthroposophy to be the foundation, simply because we believe that a real pedagogy can flow from it. Our Catholic pupils are taught by visiting Catholic priests, and our Protestant pupils by visiting Protestant ministers. Waldorf pupils, whose parents are freethinkers, and who otherwise would not receive any religious instruction at all, are given religion lessons by our own teachers. However, the surprising fact has emerged that nearly all our Waldorf pupils now attend the religion lessons given by Waldorf teachers. They have all flocked to the so-called free religion lessons, lessons which in their own way comprise what permeates all our teaching. These free religion lessons have certainly caused us a great deal of concern. With regard to these lessons, our relationship to the school is quite an unusual one. We consider all the other subjects as a necessary and intrinsic part of our education from the point of view of the principles and methods resulting from anthroposophical research. But in the case of the free religion lessons, we feel ourselves to be on the same footing as the visiting Catholic or Protestant teachers. In this sense, Waldorf teachers who give religion lessons are also outsiders. We do not wish to have an ideological or confessional school, not in an anthroposophical sense either. Nevertheless, our anthroposophical methods have shown themselves to become very fertile ground for just these free religion lessons, in which we do not teach anthroposophy, but which we build up and form according to the methods already characterized. Many objections have been raised against these free religion lessons, not least because so many children have changed over from the denominational to the free religion lessons. This has brought many other difficulties in its train, for despite our shortage of teachers, we had to find among our existing staff one new religion teacher after another. It is hardly our fault if pupils desert their denominational religion lessons because they wish to join the free religion lessons. The obvious reason is that the visiting religion teachers do not apply Waldorf methods, and the right methods are always the decisive factor, in religious instruction too. Answer to a further question regarding religion lessons. Rudolf Steiner. The characteristic mark of Waldorf education should be that all educational questions and problems are considered only from the pedagogical angle, and religion lessons are no exception. The Reverend Mr. X surely will admit that the two directions mentioned, namely the possibility of replacing religion lessons by moral tuition on the one hand and that of denominational schools on the other, have been raised from quite different viewpoints. I think instead of moral tuition, it's supposed to be moral intuition. The suggestion of replacing religious instruction by lessons in moral conduct is usually made by people who wish to do away with religion altogether, and who are of the opinion that religion has become more or less superfluous. On the other hand, a tendency toward religious dogma easily brings about a longing for denominational schools. Neither of these are pedagogical points of view. In order to link them a little more precisely to the pedagogical aspect, I would like to ask what it is that constitutes the pedagogical point of view. It is surely the presupposition that a human being is not yet complete during the stage of childhood or youth, something only too plain to see. The child has to grow gradually into a full human individual, which it will achieve only during the course of life. This implies that all potential and dormant faculties in the child should be educated, and here we have the pedagogical point of view in its most abstract form. If now someone who represents the purely pedagogical outlook resulting from insight into human nature declares that the child comes into the world with an inborn kinship to the religious element, and that during the first 7 years its corporality is steeped in religion, only to hear a call for replacing religion lessons by lessons in ethics, it must strike him as if the adherents of such an idea were unwilling to exercise a human limb, say a leg, because they had concluded that the human being needs to be trained in every respect except in the use of legs. To call for the exclusion of an essential part of the human being can only stem from a fanatical attitude, but never from a real pedagogy. Insofar as only pedagogical principles are being defended and pedagogical impulses scrutinized here, the necessity of religious in teaching certainly follows from the pedagogical point of view. This is the reason why we have established the free religion lessons for those children, who, according to the regulations of the school authorities, would otherwise have been deprived of religious instruction, as already stated. Through this arrangement, and through the fact that all the children belonging to this category are attending the free religion lessons, there is no pupil in the Waldorf school who does not have religious instruction. This procedure has made it possible for us to bring back the religious life into the entire school. To speak about the proper cultivation of the religious life at school, and to counter the effects of the so-called, quote, religion-free enlightenment, close quote, by appealing to the inborn religious disposition in the young, may be the best way forward toward a religious renewal. I consider it some kind of success for the Waldorf school to have brought religion to the children of religious dissidents. The Catholic and Protestant children would have received religious instruction in any case, but it really was not at all easy to find the appropriate form to enable us to open the subject to all our children. It was striven for only from the pedagogical point of view. Next question and answer is from Dornach, April 19, 1923. In answer to a question regarding music lessons given to a girl of 17, Rudolf Steiner. The essential thing is what Herr Baumann has already presented to us. With the onset of puberty and during the years following it, a certain musical judgment takes the place of a previous feeling for music and of a general musical experience. The faculty of forming musical judgments emerges. This becomes very noticeable through the phenomenon characterized by Herr Baumann, namely that a certain self-observation begins to manifest itself, a self-observation of the pupil's own singing, and with it the possibility of using the voice more consciously, and so on. This has to be cultivated methodically. But at the same time, something else becomes very noticeable, namely that from this stage onward, the natural musical memory begins to weaken a little, with the effect that pupils have to make greater efforts in remembering music. This is something which has to be specially borne in mind during music lessons. Whereas, prior to puberty, the children's relationship to music was a spontaneous, natural one, and because of it their musical memory was excellent, some of them now begin to encounter difficulties, not in taking in the music, but in remembering it. This needs to be seen to. One must try to go over the same music several times, not by immediate repetition, but intermittently. Another characteristic sign, just at this stage, is that whereas, previously, the instrumental and vocal parts of a piece were experienced as a unity, after the 16th to 17th year they are listened to with clear discrimination. From a psychological point of view, there is a fine and intimate difference between these two ways of listening. At this age, musical instruments are listened to far more consciously. There is also a greater understanding for the musical qualities of the various instruments used. Whereas earlier the instrument appeared to join in with the singing, it is now heard as a separate part. Listening and singing become two separate, though parallel, activities. This new relationship between singing and the appreciation of the part played by musical instruments is characteristic of this new stage, and the methods of teaching must be changed accordingly. What is important is not to introduce any music theory before this age. Music should be approached directly, and any theoretical observations a teacher may wish to make should come out of the pupil's practical experience of it. Gradually it should become possible for pupils of this age to make the transition toward forming musical judgments on a more rational basis. What Herr Baumann indicated at the end of his contribution, namely that one can make use of the ways in which pupils express themselves musically for increasing certain aspects of their self-knowledge, is absolutely correct. For instance, in the Waldorf School, we let the older pupils do some modeling, and there, right from the start, one can perceive individual characteristics in what they produce. When you ask children to model something or other, their work will always display distinctly individual features. But with regard to musical activities, only when the age of 16 to 17 is reached can the teacher go into the pupil's more individual characteristics. Then, in order to avoid one-sidedness, it is right to deal with questions posed by too great an attraction for a particular musical direction. If pupils of that age should develop a passion for certain types of music, for instance, if they are strongly drawn to Wagner's music, and in our times many young people slide into becoming pure Wagnerites almost automatically, then the teacher must try to counterbalance their tendency to be swept away by music in too emotional a way, instead of their developing an appreciation of the inner configuration of the music itself. This in no way implies any criticism of Wagner's music. What happens in such a case is that the musical experience too easily slips into the emotional sphere, and consequently needs to be lifted up again into the realm of consciousness. A musician will already notice this in the quality of the pupil's singing voice. If music is experienced too much in the realm of feeling, the voice will sound differently from that of a young person who listens more to the formation of the tones and who has a correct understanding of the more structural element in music. To work toward a balanced musical feeling and understanding is of special importance at this age. Naturally, before puberty, the teacher, who is still the authority, has not yet any opportunity to work in this way. After puberty, it is no longer the teacher's authority that counts, but the weight of her or his musical judgments. Up to puberty, right or wrong is concurrent with what the teacher considers to be right or wrong. After puberty, reasons have to be given, musical reasons also. Therefore, it is very important to go deeply into the motivation of one's own musical judgments, if there is an opportunity for continuing music lessons at this age. One could spend the whole night talking about this theme if one wished to. Question: is there not an element of untruth in asking a child a question if one knows the answer? Rudolf Steiner: something highly interesting lies at the bottom of this question. Usually, if I ask a question, I do so because I want to find an answer to something unknown to me. If now I ask a child a question, knowing the answer, I commit an untruth. However, where teaching is concerned, there are always the imponderables to be reckoned with, and sometimes it becomes necessary to gain clarity about this point. To do so, I often use the following example. If, as a teacher, one wants to speak about the question of immorality in a religious and imaginative way, one might choose the following procedure. Immortality. In a religious and imaginative way, one might choose the following procedure. One could say to oneself, quote, as children are not yet able to grasp conceptual thoughts, I will make use of an image in order to convey to them the idea of the immortality of the soul. As the teacher, I am the one who knows, and my pupils are ignorant. Out of my knowledge, I will make a picture for them. I will say to them, look at a chrysalis. When the time is right, the chrysalis opens and a beautiful butterfly flies out. And just as the butterfly flies out of the chrysalis, so the immortal soul flies out of the body when a human being dies. Close quote. This is one way of approaching the subject. Fine. But if such be one's attitude, one may find that the image chosen does not create a deep impression in the children at all. The reason is that the teacher, with all his or her ingenuity, does not believe in the truth of this image, which is used only as a means of illustrating the issue of immortality to ignorant children. But there is also another possibility, namely that the teacher believes in the truth of this picture, and then one's attitude could be, if despite my limited knowledge and wisdom, I have an awareness of what is real in the world, I do believe in the truth of this image. I know that it is not I who invented it, but that it has been placed into the world by the powers that have ordained the world. In the creeping out of the butterfly from the chrysalis, there is rendered on a lower level, but in sense perceptible form, what happens when the immortal human soul leaves the body. And in this revelation I can and do believe. Note well the difference. If teachers believe in the truth of their images and the words used to describe them, their inner attitude will communicate itself to their pupils. One can find innumerable examples of this. And so, in a similar way, the imponderables play into the interesting question which has just been raised. The point is not that, as the teacher, one is of the opinion, quote, I know my subject, the child does not know it, and I now ask my question pretending that I want to hear the answer to something I do not know, close quote. After all, it makes a great difference whether I ask the child a question, say about the Battle of Tzaben, and I know the answer, but the child does not, or whether I know the answer and the child does too. The untruth would lie in asking something I already know, but I could also have a different attitude, namely, that the way the child answers the question is of interest to me. I may phrase my question to find out what the child feels and thinks about a particular point. In that case, I do not know beforehand what the child will say. Child's answer can have many different shades or nuances. Let us assume that the ideal attitude of a teacher, something I have often emphasized in my lectures, is that not even the wisest is beyond being able to learn something even from a tiny babe. For however far one may have advanced in scientific knowledge, a baby's cry still can teach one a great deal. If this be the ideal, the way a child answers each question will help teachers to learn how to teach. If teachers ask questions, it does not imply that they want to hear from their pupils something they already know, but that they themselves want to learn from the way a child answers. Then they will also phrase their questions rightly. For instance, they may formulate a question like this, what does this mean to you? Already the tone of voice may indicate the teacher's interest in how the child will answer. It is a fact that much depends on the imponderables that play into what is happening between teacher and child. If one knows what is going on in the child's subconscious, one will make many other discoveries as well. The whole question of untruth in the teacher also belongs to this theme, such as we find if teachers stand in front of their classes, teaching out of books or using written notes. It certainly can be very convenient for them, but such expediency has quite a devastating effect upon the actual teaching. For in their subconscious, the children are continually forming the judgment, why should we have to learn what even they do not know? Why are we made to know what they are reading out of their books? This is an even greater untruth which enters the classroom than if teachers ask questions. Even when giving dictations, teachers should avoid dictating from books. If one is perceptive of what is going on in the child, and if the child can feel that the teacher is genuinely interested in the pupils, and therefore not asking questions with false undertones, the whole situation is an entirely different one. Then teachers can safely ask their questions without fear of introducing an element of untruth into their lessons. Q&A from Dornach, April 22, 1923. Question. Would it be possible to implement Waldorf pedagogy in other countries, in Czechoslovakia, for example? Rudolf Steiner. In principle, it is possible to introduce Waldorf education anywhere, where it is based purely upon pedagogy. The significant difference between Waldorf pedagogy and other educational movements consists in just this fact. As you know, there are people today who maintain that if one wants to give pupils a proper education, one must send them to a country boarding school, where they consider an urban environment unsuitable for children's education. Then there are those who are of the opinion that only a boarding school can offer the proper conditions for their children's education, while others again insist that only life at home provides the right background for children. All these things cease to be of prime importance in Waldorf education. I have no wish to quarrel over these different attitudes, each of which may have its justification from one or the other point of view. But since Waldorf education is focused entirely on the pedagogical aspect, it can be adapted to all outer conditions, be they those of a town school, a country school, or whatever. It is not designed to meet specific outer conditions, but is based entirely on observation and insight into the growing human being. This means that Waldorf pedagogy could be implemented in every school. What is an entirely different question is whether this would be allowed to happen, whether the powers responsible for education and for making the curricula and so on would ever agree to such a step being taken. There is nothing to stop Waldorf pedagogy from being applied anywhere in the world, even tomorrow. But the real question is whether permission for this to happen would be granted. This question can be answered only in terms of the various local government policies. That is really all one can say about it. Question regarding recitation and eurythmy. Rudolf Steiner. It is a pity that Frau Dr. Steiner, who has developed the art of recitation here in Dornach, has been ill these last few days, and therefore unable to give us examples of recitation. The point is that eurythmy requires one to revive the kind of recitation and declamation that was cultivated in times more open to an artistic approach to speech than our present times. Our present age is hardly sensitive to artistic refinement. For instance, people today would not readily understand why Goethe, like a musical conductor, used a baton when rehearsing his iambic dramas with his actors. In our times, in recitation and declamation, both of which have to be strictly distinguished one from the other, the prose content is usually given prime consideration. At least since the 1890s, a strong tendency has developed to assign more of a secondary place to the artistic formation of speech, while the prose content of a poem is considered to be of first importance. And yet the essentials in speech have to be seen in the imaginative formation of the sounds, in the structure of the verses, in the musical and thematic treatment, in rhythm, beat, and in the melodious themes, all of which are fundamental aspects of poetry. Through the way in which speech is treated, they all have to be lifted up to a higher level than would be possible by means of prose content alone. The feeling for the artistic element in speech has declined altogether in more recent times, as some of our present cultural phenomena will confirm. For instance, I don't believe that there are many people today who remember or who have noticed which university chair the well-known Professor Curtius originally occupied at the University of Berlin. He has been lecturing on history of art and other related subjects, but these were not the subjects for which he was originally engaged. In actual fact, he began his university career as professor of eloquence, and his real task was to lecture on rhetoric. But interest in this subject waned to such an extent that eventually it appeared unnecessary for him to continue lecturing about it, and so he quietly slipped into another university chair. Similar symptoms can be frequently met with today. If the art of recitation is to be resuscitated, preferably more in form of a narrative style or as the kind of poetry the ancient Greeks developed, and if the art of declamation, upon which the older Germanic poetry is founded, is also to be revived, it is necessary to do something about speech formation. This is the point. I do not know what caused this question to be raised, but what matters is that one achieves, through the way in which speech is treated, what is achieved in prose through the word content. It is not the emphasis on the prose meaning, but the way the different sounds follow each other, or the uses of rhymes, alliterations, and rhythms. In other words, the element of form in language, which has to bring out what the present emphasis on prose content is achieving today. Recitation is more closely allied to measure and to the plasticity of language. Its qualities are realized either through a lengthening or shortening of syllables, something which can be of special significance in ballads. In declamation, on the other hand, particular qualities are brought about by an alternation of pitch to a higher or lower tone of voice. The questioner had noticed that in the word greeting, the first and second syllable had been pronounced with equal stress. This is not a question of art, but only a matter of interpretation. It depends entirely on whether the speaker places the main value on the first syllable or on both syllables equally, that is, Tell her I send greetings, or tell her I send greetings. Question. Does this not shift the weight of the rhyme? Rudolf Steiner. This could happen only if one neglected to adapt the other syllables accordingly. It is all a question of mood rather than of how speech is treated. Question. Is not an inherent law expressing itself in a person's interpretation? Rudolf Steiner. No, one's interpretation has to remain free. It is absolutely possible to artistically render one and the same poem either in the style of declamation or of recitation. There is room for the most varied conceptions, just as a musical work can be interpreted in the most varied ways. There is not just one way of dealing with a poem. What matters is its innate essence, so that when either reciting or declaiming, one no longer has the feeling that one recites or declaims with the larynx, but that one is speaking with the air. To develop the gift of shaping the air is what matters above all in recitation. When singing, one shapes the air. When reciting, there has to be the same tendency, only in speech the melody already lies within the sound. It is in the way speech is treated that the essentials have to be brought out, and not through the content. In this context, it is helpful to take into account what happened when Schiller wrote his most important poems, namely that he had a general melody in his soul to which he could then write the text he was looking for. One has to aim at expressing the essentials on the one hand through the musical element, and on the other through the formative and painterly qualities of language. Question. In the art of dancing, different dancers have their different styles. This presumably is not the case in Eurythmy, for are its movements not always the same? Rudolf Steiner. You would hardly say so if you saw a great deal of Eurythmy. Let us say, for example, you recited a poem and another person recited the same poem. Even if you treated the poem in the same way, from an artistic point of view, there would still be two different voice registers, and so on. This kind of difference already comes out very strongly in Eurythmy, where you would soon be able to perceive the individual characteristics of the different Eurythmists. For these are there, and if they have not yet become more prominent, it is only because Eurythmy has not been developed far enough. It will happen when it has advanced to the point where the Eurythmists really become one with their art. Then a more individual interpretation will become more noticeable. Certainly in Eurythmy, all movements are based on fundamental laws. You could find a parallel in speech. If I wish to say man, I must not say moon. I must not pronounce an oo instead of an a. The Eurythmist, therefore, has to make the appropriate Eurythmy gesture for a. But this underlying law in Eurythmy still permits a multiplicity of possibilities for bringing out an individual interpretation. We are not dealing here with pedantic or stereotypical movements. You will also see a great difference between a beginner practicing Eurythmy and someone who has done it for years, not only as regards skills in movement, but also in the artistry shown. Likewise, an inborn artistic gift will also be clearly perceptible, even more so than in other art forms. Eurythmy is essentially built into the human organism. The human organism incorporates it in such a way that, like the other arts, such as painting, it is not absorbed rationally, but nevertheless consciously, whereas dancing goes over into the emotional sphere. There, other difficulties may arise. Dancing is not really something purely artistic. Eurythmy is already an art. The participants of the course expressed the wish to found an association with the aim of opening up a Waldorf school in Switzerland. During various deliberations, the question was raised whether priority should be given to the rebuilding of the Goetheanum or to the founding of a Waldorf school, since the realization of both projects seemed entirely beyond the realm of possibility. Rudolf Steiner. To build up the Goetheanum again is more or less a matter of course, not only among Swiss circles, but among the wider circles of anthroposophists in the world. During the years in which it was standing, the Goetheanum gradually came to be looked upon as something that was to represent the center of the entire anthroposophical movement. and there will hardly be any doubt among the majority of anthroposophists in the world that the Gertianum will have to be built up again. Hindrances toward this aim could come only from the Swiss authorities. There can be no other hindrances. Unless the powers that be should make it impossible for us, the Gertianum will certainly be built again. On the other hand, while the Gertianum was standing, the need was felt to open at least a small school, for whatever springs from the impulses of anthroposophy must find practical application in life, by its very nature. As you already know, many other practical activities are the outcome of anthroposophical work, for instance, in the field of medicine. I want to mention this only for the sake of clarification. Regarding the possibility of anthroposophical medicine, I also had to stipulate that if ever the thought should arise of working in medicine on the basis of anthroposophical research, it would be essential for those wishing to dedicate themselves to such a task to be in constant touch with ill persons through their personal care. This is the reason why here in Arlesheim and in Stuttgart our hospitals were opened. This only as an example to show that if any impulses in one or another direction are to grow out of anthroposophy, these and other institutions are bound to spring up by sheer necessity. And so in building up this small school, which is closely affiliated to the Gertianum, and which we shall endeavor to keep going, we have done the only possible thing. We started it because a number of parents, who were convinced of the rightness of Waldorf education, wanted to send us their children. It was only through the interference of the local authorities that these children were taken away from us again. Due to Swiss legislation, we were unable to do, even on a smaller scale, what had been possible in Stuttgart, where, owing to less restrictive local educational laws, we could open the Waldorf school. In this respect, world progress has shown some very strange features. Please do not think that I am trying to promote conservative or reactionary tendencies by what I am going to say, but it is a fact that as far as education is concerned, there was greater freedom during the times when liberalism was non-existent, not to mention democracy. Lack of freedom has crept in only during the times of liberalism and democracy. I am not even maintaining that lack of freedom and liberalism, lack of freedom and democracy, definitely belong together, but during the course of history they have shown themselves to be closely connected. And the least free of all educational systems in, shall I say, the civilized world, in that part of Europe which is looked upon by so many West European democrats as a kind of paradise, is found in Soviet Russia. There freedom is being exterminated root and branch through the most extreme form of democracy, as it is called, and an educational system has been set up that represents a caricature of human freedom and of human activity. To return to our question, I wish to strongly emphasize that the rebuilding of the Gertianum is a necessity, and that it should be prevented, that it could be prevented only by outer circumstances. In any case, it should be striven for. As a matter of course, this aim will be resolutely pursued by all those who are serious about anthroposophy. As soon as official matters have been finalized, we shall certainly make every effort in this direction. One can take only one step at a time. If one does not wish to proceed in a theoretical way, One can take only one step at a time if one does not wish to proceed in a theoretical way. It is, of course, possible to make all kinds of decisions and to think out all kinds of plans. But if one stands firmly on the ground of reality, one will do so only if and when there is a sufficiently strong basis to warrant it. Naturally, the ideal solution would be if what could be founded to the building of a new Gertianum toward a general spiritual and social life were to find its natural complement in the building of a Waldorf school. But in order to move forward in this direction, one would first have to overcome the obstacles put in the way by inhibiting interests in this country. On my part, I feel convinced that if only enough people can be found, and here I am not thinking in terms of majorities, who recognize that such a school is a necessity, it will eventually be opened. There is no question that ways and means will be found for it to come into being. Concerning the building of the Gertianum, matters are not so simple. to bring it about out of the will forces of Switzerland, if I may put it this way, is not so easy. This would have to be a matter of international effort and cooperation. Primary schools, on the other hand, spring from the various folk cultures, and in such cases neither our Waldorf teachers, nor I, nor any other person, has any say in the matter except our dear Swiss friends and visitors, and because of this we feel a great need to hear more about their feelings and attitudes concerning this point. After further contributions from various conference members, Rudolf Steiner was asked to speak the final words. Rudolf Steiner: Our chairman is of the opinion that I should say a few words in conclusion. In response, all I can do is to express my deep inner satisfaction about the best of will and the best of intentions our honored visitors gathered here have shown during this conference. And I must say that every coming together of this kind is a joyful event, in that it makes the participants realize that what is being cultivated here in Dornach is quite different from the misrepresentations that are current among so many people. If there are a sufficiently large number of individuals who by their own experience come to realize how many untruths are being broadcast about what is actually happening in Dornach, then the time will come when what is intended here, however feeble our beginnings may be, will reach the world more freely. Naturally, not everyone is in a position to clearly perceive the curious ways in which what is happening here in Dornach is being distorted. There are moments when one cannot help feeling amazed at the lack of morality shown by members of the public, and at the general indifference to flagrant distortions and falsifications, which really belong to the field of immorality. One cannot but wonder how it is possible that such perversions of truth are taken in with a certain phlegma. Matters have gone so far that if one touches upon this subject, one is almost met with incredulity. Only yesterday, the name of a personality who commands a large hearing here in Switzerland was mentioned. If now one feels it necessary to state that this personality criticized my book titled Toward Social Renewal, even before it was published, that is, before he could possibly have read one single word contained in it, the untruth of such a criticism, spread by a person of considerable fame, will hardly cause a raised eyebrow. So great and widespread is the general phlegma concerning ethical matters today. Through it these negative influences gather momentum. They increase tremendously. About 2 years ago, a certain matter was spoken about repeatedly, namely that a theologian had written a booklet in Switzerland in which the grotesque words were printed that here in Dornach a wooden sculpture was to be erected which could already be seen in the studio and which bore luciferic features in the upper part and animal-like features down below. The fact is that the main figure of this sculpture shows the features of Christ in ideal form, while the lower part of the carving is as yet incomplete. When he was called to account, the author of the booklet simply declared that he had copied the offending words from somebody else's writings, and this despite the fact that the author of the pamphlet was a well-known person in Switzerland. This incident has been brought to the notice of our circle here several times, and not without a decisive edge. But owing to the general phlegma concerning moral matters, our words have fallen on deaf ears, instead of being passed on to widest circles as an example of how strong the inclinations are, even in famous people, to distort anthroposophy and everything belonging to it by spreading untruths and gross inaccuracies. Well, one could continue in this vein, but I am afraid that if I were to tell you even only a small part of all the untruths, real untruths, which are being spread concerning anthroposophy, we would not be able to go home before sunrise, and naturally we have no wish to do that. Nevertheless, the situation is such that one has to point out once again that everything is becoming so difficult for us because of the untruths about Dornach and all that belongs to it, untruths which are being disseminated in most underhand ways, and also because of the general indifference with which these perversions of the truth are met. I am not begging you to come to the defense of Dornach, certainly not, and yet there is something of real significance in all this. Many people hold the view that there must be complete freedom to express one's opinion. Certainly everybody is entitled to a personal opinion, and no one can support this point of view more strongly than I do. It is a matter of course that everyone must be free to have an individual opinion and also to express it. But no one ought to spread untruths in the world without hearing an appropriate and authoritative answer. It is the spreading of untruths which causes the greatest disturbances in the world. To make people see this is one of the most difficult things we have to contend with here in Dornach. We have very many good friends, but the enthusiasm for defending the truth by rectifying false accounts of what is emanating from Dornach has not yet become very strong. Our difficulties are more connected with these things than one might think. For instance, not long ago I was faced with a very large number of untruths, of untrue judgments, which were aimed at me personally. As in this particular case, it mattered a great deal to me to rectify judgments people would form on the basis of these untruths, I asked, quote, what would happen if, in order to disprove all these untruths, I were to submit, within a short time, documentary evidence, clearly set out and concisely written for quick and easy reading, close quote. The answer was, quote, it would not alter the situation in any way, close quote. Here you have some indications of the difficulties of which it can be said that they are at the root of our troubles. Rectifying the many untruths about Dornach, scattered far and wide, would certainly be a most desirable thing. The collection of funds for the creation of a Swiss school association would not be so difficult if there were less distrust everywhere. But I believe that this lack of trust will persist as long as one is not in the position of placing the actual facts side by side with the untruths, and as long as one is not able to count on a sufficiently large number of people who are not only capable of discriminating between truth and untruth, but who are also willing to stand up for the truth. Things have come to such a pass that quite recently I had to say to a number of people, to prove the truth regarding our anthroposophical cause would bring us the greatest of harm, because we should be far less unpopular if the untruths told about us were correct. In that case, people could vilify us without any qualms. But those who stand behind these untruths about Dornach and anthroposophy know quite well that they are scattering lies. Hence, to prove them wrong would cause them the greatest of discomfort. This is also how things are where personal matters are concerned. I am not exposing this situation to you merely to talk about it once again, but rather to look upon it as the shadow cast by light. In order to give light its proper brightness, there has to be some shadow, and the brighter the light, the darker the accompanying shadow. I put these things before you as the counterpart of the positive side. But just because they are there, you may believe me that it gives me all the more joy to have witnessed how so many among you have spoken tonight about your deeply felt desire to do something for the cause represented here. In expressing my heartfelt satisfaction to you, I also wish to put the light next to the shadow, which, as already said, was placed before you only to let the light shine more brightly. Through the fact that so many of our honored visitors, dear to us, have spoken with voices of such deep concern about our anthroposophical cause, this light has been shining especially bright. The end of this ninth section on question and answers.